This is AWLS, podcasts on wilderness medicine from the University of Utah School of Medicine.
Hi, this is Richard Ingebretson from the University of Utah School of Medicine. I have a very special guest today, the founder and past CEO of Black Diamond Equipment, Peter Metcalf. He had a very interesting and really rather remarkable experience up in Alaska, and he's going to share his story with us. How are you, Peter?
I'm doing very well, Rich, and thank you for having me on your podcast here. Yeah, my story is about a climbing expedition that I had early in May of 1980, so over 40 years ago. For those who are not familiar with the Alaska Range, there are three peaks that dominate that range, the three giants. One is Mount McKinley, or now known as Denali, the native name, Mount Foraker, and Mount Hunter. And this is about Mount Hunter. And when you see these three mountains from the bush town, the jumping off point where you fly in from of Talkeetna, Alaska, the south face of Mount Hunter and its central rib are highly visible. It's an amazing line, and you can see it all the way on a clear day from Talkeetna, 60 miles away. And in May of 1980, myself and my two close climbing partners, who we had done a lot of climbing together with over the years, flew into the south face of Mount Hunter to the first alpine-style ascent of the central rib of the south face. It's a very long route, very technical, both with rocks, deep ice, long fluted ridges, and then the descent would be not down the route. We didn't think we could reverse it, but instead descending the very long and technically challenging as well west ridge that had been climbed probably a dozen times at this point in time. I had tried the route 2 years earlier or 3 years earlier in 1977 and had failed low down on the route for a variety of reasons, but it gave me insight as to what we needed to do to have a chance at succeeding. And my strategy for doing this climb with two partners was that we would do it alpine style, which means you carry everything you need on your back for the whole time. Two, that we would do it in 7 days, and I thought it would be possible to do in 7 days as I looked at past climbing, the climbing I had done in Europe on some of the big north faces of the Alps. And then in order to get our pack weight down, I determined that we would not bring tents, only bivouac sacks, and that we would, wherever possible, dig snow caves. Obviously, at this point in time in Alaska, in May, you can have below zero temperatures in the day and at night, and below zero up high. And then we brought, like I said, 7 days worth of food, enough blue eye canisters to make sure that we could last longer in melting snow for water, because all of your water comes from melting snow. And then it is all the gear we needed, but nothing more, a light rack of ice screws and climbing hardware and that sort of thing. So we flew in early in May of 1980 on a reasonably clear day, landed on the glacier late that afternoon, did the approach to the route, and just got in our bivouac sacks and went to sleep. We woke up in the morning and it dawned clear, so we began the climbing in earnest and made very good progress that first day. Got to a place where we could bivouac, that's camp, on the spur proper, and it began to snow lightly. Little were we to know that began about 2 weeks of pretty horrendous weather, and I should add that when I say horrendous, snowing every day to some extent or another, and some days true blizzards. And what we learned after this climb that would end up taking us 13 days versus the 6 or 7 days I had planned was that the weather was so bad that very few climbing parties got up routes on Mount McKinley or some of the other surrounding peaks. So we began climbing and realized very early on that the climbing was more difficult and challenging than we had anticipated, but we were still making progress. And bivvy the second night, this time again in the open without a snow cave, because there was no place really to dig in, and we found ourselves at what was going to be the technical rock climbing crux at the base of about a 400 or 500 foot rock headwall that we had to climb and then ascend and get above that, where we would then be primarily on ice, snow and ice, and some rock. At this time, by the time we got to the top of the rock, we recognized that we were moving more slowly than we had thought, but rationalized it with, hey, we're fit, we're strong. I don't think anybody else could do this any faster than we're doing, so we're fine. We should just keep going. In hindsight, we realized how irrational that logic was, but at the time, it seemed perfectly rational to us. So with that, we decided to keep going, climbing 14 or 15 hours a day. In this time of year in Alaska, you have very, very long days, so you can do that. I think it was on the fourth day that the weather really began to turn on us and get quite inclement, stormy, blizzardy. But nonetheless, we knew that because we had been going slower than we had anticipated, we needed to keep moving. We didn't have the luxury not to climb. So with every stitch of clothing on that we had, we continued to climb and ascend this route. And it was on this day, I think it was day four, that we had to climb through the storm up a series of very steep ice footings. This is a footing is like a rib of ice, very hollow, a lot of air pockets in it, and they make up the surface of the knife edge ridge above us. We can't climb in the knife edge. You can't do that. So you're traversing up and along these fluted ice ridges that are very difficult to get an ice screw in because they have these pockets of air. So progress was tenuous, but we continued to make progress through the storm, with us recognizing also that we needed to, as it began to get dark, it does finally get dark, that we needed to find a place to get out of this storm. We were getting hypothermic from the cold, even with our heavy duvets on. And of course, we were belaying, taking turns climbing, and then a leader would get an anchor somehow and bring the others up to him. Finally, we found a place where the angle relented, the ice turned to snow, and we thought we could dig in. And in these kind of conditions, digging in, we had one shovel between us and ice axes. You take turns digging, and it probably took 90 minutes at least before we had a snow hole or snow cave dug big enough for three guys to crawl into and enough room to get the stove going to melt snow for water. And once we got in there, it was that little snow hole, which some would consider a coffin, but to be off the verticality and out of the heart of the blizzard in a snow hole with no wind, where your body temperatures were bringing that room up into the probably the 20 to almost 30 degree range, it was such a relief to finally relax and think through what the heck is going on and what do we do. In the morning, the storm had abated. We crawled out into the light, discussed our situation, and realized at that point that here we were, day four, still a long way to go, and what we thought would be a 6 or 7 day climb, and that we could not descend. And typically in climbing, in doing new routes or even existing long routes, part of your cerebral energy and powers are going to always thinking through, how will you retreat? How are you going to get down? And we discussed this and realized that the climbing that we had done that previous day up these unprotectable fluted ridges that were very steep, and then along this knife edge in sections and back to the fluted ridges, there's no way that we could reverse that and down climb that with any idea of safety, let alone the rock climbing we had done and everything else. And that at this point in time, our belief was that the only way to live, or let alone succeed on the route, was to climb this thing and move forward. And so on one hand, that was you'd think some ways rather intimidating and scary, and yes, it was, but in other ways, it was incredibly liberating, because rather than spend 20 or 30% of our mental energy always thinking about how we get off this thing, and somehow that prevents you from committing yourself 110%, which a route like this requires, well, the retreat option was gone. So now everything was absolutely focused on ascending the route and then figuring out then how we were going to get down. So the next several days of climbing proved to be as challenging as that came before it. The weather became rather inclement again, and at times just horrific. There was one night we dug a snow cave where the wind shifted, and the snow cave was just filling with snow. So at first light, which is about 4 a.m., we were out of there, just buried in snow. I was lucky to find my glasses. I do wear glasses, and you take them off at night. We were wearing our boots to bed at this point in time to help maintain our warmth and just the difficulty of taking the boots off, which I think in hindsight I know was probably a mistake, because you really do need to dry your feet out. And though we had winter boots, these technical double boots, they do slowly get damp. You do sweat, and it would have been smarter to have taken our feet out of the boots, get the inner boots out, dry them in the sleeping bag, which on future expeditions I always did. But I think that was definitely causing our feet to get colder and exposing ourselves. And then I think it was day five or six. Back on day four, we realized we were going slower than we thought. So right then and there, we started to cut our rations. Fortunately, we had enough fuel to keep ourselves fairly hydrated by melting the snow, but we began cutting rations. And so what had already been pretty lean rations, because there's a limit to how much weight you can carry for a 6 or 7 day climb, became lighter and lighter. And I think that lack of food probably weakened ourselves a little bit to the potential of future frostbite. And I think it was on day 10, 9 or 10, that we were finally at the very near the top of the spur that finishes up on what is Mount Hunter's summit plateau. It has a large summit plateau, 400 or 500 feet below the actual summit, that's dead flat. And in the final pitch or two to get off the spur, there was some steep ice climbing up to the edge of the plateau, which was protected by a very large overhanging cornice. It was my partner's lead to get out there to climb that, as I belayed him, and the other partner stayed with me. And then suddenly the rope just quit moving. And it was storming wildly, but through the storm we heard our partner Glenn yell down that his crampon had broken, and that he was trying to figure out a repair there with some slings or tape he had hanging from an ice screw. At that point, I was so incredibly cold and shivering, even with my duvet on in the storm and the growing dusk, that I told Pete, tie off my other partner, tie off Glenn, give me a belay. I'm going to climb up to Glenn and see how I can help him. And I might then, depending on the situation, lead on and try to get to the summit plateau where I was sure we could dig in. When I got to Glenn, he was hanging from his ice tools and an ice screw, working on his crampons, which had cracked and a piece had broken. And he was trying to tape them with some tape together in a way so he could climb. He said he was fine. He had his heavy mittens off and some lightweight wool gloves, and he had whipped one of those off, which I hadn't really thought much about as I passed him. I was more concerned about the cold, finishing the route, trying to get up to the summit plateau for us to dig in, because we were all getting truly hypothermic at this moment. So with him seemingly okay, I continued to lead up, got to the cornice, and then had to probably take a half an hour while on my front points and with my front picks of my tool, one of my tools in, chop away at this cornice so I could climb up over it and get onto the summit plateau. And I remember at some point tiring quickly after what was already a long day, thinking how insane it was about to, I felt like it was about to pop off, how insane it would be here within a foot of the plateau to lose it and go tumbling down, which probably would have been the end. Anyway, made it through, got up onto the plateau, got myself anchored with my two ice axes, brought up Pete, our third partner, and then at this point, Glenn was ready to come up, and we brought him up. And when we got up there, you know, we were still in the storm, but we found a good place very early on against a rise to dig in and began madly trying to dig in to the slope to dig a small snow hole or snow cave so we could get out of this damn storm. We finally succeeded. It was probably 90 minutes of ferocious chopping and digging to dig something big enough for the three of us to slide into and get into our sleeping bags and get the stove going. As soon as we had done that and turned on the headlamp, I got the stove going and all, and we were just numb with cold. Feet were numb, hands were kind of numb. But they were warming up, and it was Glenn who, as I was melting the snow, said, as he took his, looked at his hand, which I didn't look at, he goes, "Gosh, I think I may have gotten some frostbite in my hands. They're pretty numb here. I'm going to try to warm them up." And we all felt like we had numb fingers and toes and all, so I didn't think more of it at that time. The focus was, each of us focused on ourselves, trying to take care of ourselves, get as much snow melted to hydrate, and then heat up some tea. We were out of food, most of the food at this point in time. Had some nuts, some tea, and I think some hot chocolate. And then we all crashed, just exhausted from the day's effort. Awoke the next morning at first light, looked out, and it had cleared quite a bit, which was a godsend because where we were required visible orientation to find where the West Ridge came off of the plateau. As we got up in the morning, Glenn said, "Oh my gosh, I really did frost my fingers badly. I need help." And I looked, turned over him in the cave and looked at his fingers, and they were nothing but large black and blue blisters on his hands. I didn't bother to look at my feet or Pete's, other than to know that we probably had frostbite on our toes, but that's something that's much easier to deal with at a future time. You can keep climbing with that. But it became clear very quickly that Glenn, with his frostbitten hands, fingers, now with the blisters, didn't have the dexterity to do some of the things like lace up his boots and do other things that require, or get his harness on and get the webbing through the buckle and this sort of thing. So we had to help him with that. And took care of that issue and realized we need to get down and we're going to need help with this frostbite. And we're going to need to find this West Ridge. And as I said, fortunately, it had cleared enough on this large mile-and-a-half-long summit plateau, which is rather indistinct at this altitude of 14,000 feet. And with a compass and visible clues, we worked our way in the direction of where we thought the West Ridge would drop off of the plateau. It would be the way that we would then work our way down off this mountain in a day or two. Fortunately, we found the West Ridge, got partway down it before the next storm rolled in, and we began working our way down down the ridge. And fortunately, the initial down climbing was really hiking, steep hiking, and Glenn could hold onto the top of his ice axe okay. But the next day, and so we had another night on the ridge. We had originally hoped that we could get off there more quickly, but we had another night there, dug another cave, heated up now water, melted snow, heated up water, and reused our tea bags for the second or third time. And at this point, we were totally out of food and down to just drinking hot water. Next morning, got up, helped Glenn with his harness, with his getting his crampons on and this sort of thing, and got to a rather steep ice face with four or five pitches of ice climbing that we had to descend steep ice. And unfortunately, just through the climb, we had slowly lost gear, had to be left. We dropped one or two items, et cetera, et cetera. And at this point on this ice face, we were down to two ice screws alone. So what would happen is I would anchor, be the first one down, set the screw, one screw, and my tools. I would then have Pete rappel down from the anchors backed up by my ice axes. I would then lower Glenn because he was not capable of down climbing any ice to Pete. Pete would help secure him. Then I would take out my one screw and then down climb the 150 feet down to Pete. And then I would repeat that process for five pitches. At this point, I think it was probably fair to say I was still the strongest and fittest climber to do the solo down climbing and lowering of Glenn. And we continued down this way and hoped we'd get off the ridge, but it was far longer than we had anticipated, and hence we got benighted on it in the dark, in the clouds, and once again had a bivouac. At this point in time, it was not so cold. We were exhausted and decided we'd get into our bivouac sacks, bury ourselves in some snow, and just not try to dig a cave, which was probably, on one hand, the best we could do, but it also exposed us more to the elements as well. And it was finally the next morning we got up and on day 13 worked our way down the rest of the ridge through some ice falls and large seracs and got ourselves down to the Kahiltna Glacier, which is the landing site where people come in to start the West Buttress, the most popular route on Mount McKinley. It took us a couple of hours of glacier walking and post-holing up the glacier to get to the landing site where there were other people and we might get some support and help. When we got up there, ran into other climbers we knew who were doing routes in the McKinley area. It had been a week since any pilot had been able to get in because of the storms to land new people or get people out. But there was a person there with a walkie-talkie who said there had been a break in the weather. Two planes were coming in. Others had been waiting 4 or 5 days to get out. But when people saw our situation and looked at our condition, they said, you know what? You guys need to get out of here. If the planes make it in, you are welcome to take our spots or in one of the planes. We just needed one plane, which fortunately about an hour or two after getting to that landing site, we were blessed with a plane coming down through the clouds, landing on the glacier, allowing us to get in and flying out. I will still remember with that flight out, as we started heading out, the pilot saying, you know, how bad the weather had been, and even now he was risking it flying in. And to get out from this glacier, he had to find a pass to get out because there were big walls on both sides. And there was three opportunities. He tried one that had closed down. Then he goes to the next one that had closed down. And then the third one has just got enough clearance of the clouds for him to gun towards, and him mumbling about, God, I don't know if we're going to make it. And at this moment, I just thought, well, if it's over here, it's been a great adventure for 2 weeks, you know, c'est la vie. But obviously, he got through it and took us down to Talkeetna, the bush town where we had begun the trip. Got out, got our stuff. It was late now in the day. We knew we needed to get down to the frostbite clinic at the Providence Hospital where the experts are for this for frostbite, but we got ourselves a motel room in Talkeetna just to have a warm night. It was late, where we could assess our wounds and see how bad our frostbite was on our feet and fingers. And then the next morning, we got a ride down to Talkeetna and checked ourselves into the frostbite clinic there at the Providence Hospital with being treated by the expert Wilbur Mills, who's probably one of the leading frostbite experts in the early 80s in America. As a summary, in the end, neither Pete Athens nor I lost anything from our toes. We had big black blisters. and great sensitivity, but other than surface skin, we lost nothing. Glenn, unfortunately, did lose the tips of three of his fingers. That was the price he paid. But a year later, even with the last digits missing on three fingers, he was back rock climbing at a 5'11 level, which was, back in early 80s, considered a very high level. It was a great adventure. And I think what we learned from it more than anything was simply that one needs to check one another regularly on a climb like this for something like frostbite and exposure. At the same time, the conditions, the open bivouacs that we had and what we were up against, I'm not sure there was a lot more we could have done. But in hindsight, I would have to say, to do a route like this without a tent, that's in a little bit warmer, better clothing, is a price you pay for being a little bit too lean and too exposed.
Well, Peter, I don't think that any of us can truly appreciate what you went through, even though we just listened to it. The one question that came in my mind is, did you think you were going to die?
Before I left for Mount Hunter, having been to the route once before and now really understanding from other climbs I had done the magnitude of this and how few routes had been done at this point in time, alpine style, in Alaska, I did think that there was a reasonable chance that potentially we could die on this route before I left for it. And I remember, and I say that in part because I'd already lost half a dozen climbing partners and friends in climbing on big alpine routes. And so I remember writing a letter to my parents and gave it to my brother and said that shared with, and I said, do only give this to them if I die. And it was trying to explain to them in my own words that I knew the risk, I was willing to accept them, that to do this climb was the culmination of a decade of climbing, of what my whole life had been about. And this was kind of had been my goal, to do something like this. So all of us knew the risks involved. And we were young, and I think something about being young with your whole life in front of you, you also are willing to put it all on the line for something quixotic and big and bold that you somehow think is going to make your life very fulfilled. Once we got on the route, there were times where I thought, hey, if I move ahead on this or whatever, I could die. And then I thought, well, especially after day four, is if I don't move ahead on this, I will die. So it was, we have no choice but to keep moving forward and trying this because we are fully committed. But beyond that, I never really thought much about that other than we're fully committed and we knew what we're getting into and we accepted that. And I will say that one of the goals I had for that route was to come as close to the edge, push myself to the very limit of what I could do, but survive it, because that's where the ultimate experience is at. And I will have to say Mount Hunter provided that. And as I look back on it in hindsight, I will say I'd trade nothing in my life not to have had that experience, and I would trade nothing in my life to ever repeat that experience.
Well, Peter, that has to be the most incredible adventure experience I've heard recounted. And we're glad you did it. We're glad you made it back. And we're glad you were able to recount that to us. This ends this podcast. And again, thank you for listening.